This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Within the next two decades, India's economy could become the world's third largest. Yet India today is unable to provide secure employment for the majority of its 470 million workers. Of those 470 million workers, only 35 million pay income tax. The overwhelming majority of India's 1.1 billion people live in India's 680,000 villages. Most villages are not within easy reach of health clinics or adequate elementary schools. India is a democracy, but a democracy with great challenges. It operates with 24-party coalitions, and corruption is rampant. These are some of the facts you'll find in a new book by journalist Edward Luce. Luce is the author of In Spite of the Gods, The Strange Rise of Modern India. In addition to the facts, the book contains fascinating stories that put those facts into context. Edward Luce is our guest this afternoon. We'll talk with him about India, its strengths, and its challenges. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. I invite your questions and comments for Edward Luce. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Edward Luce is the Washington bureau chief for the Financial Times. He served as the paper's South Asia bureau chief and was based in New Delhi from 2001 to 2006. His book, In Spite of the Gods, The Strange Rise of Modern India, is published by Doubleday. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Edward Luce, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Good afternoon, Celeste. Thank you for having me.
Why have you titled this book, In Spite of the Gods, The Strange Rise of India?
The Strange Rise of Modern India was really, which is the subtitle, was really the title that I preferred, but it became the subtitle. The word strange is denotes not the fact that it's strange India is rising, but the nature of the rise is strange or unusual, because it's really starting with the services sector rather than with cheap manufacturing, which is the normal route for countries to develop. It's the route that China took. It's the route China is taking. It's the route Britain took in the early 19th century and America in the late 19th century. India is starting at the other end with really quite sophisticated service sector competitiveness, and that's what's driving its economy. That's one strange aspect. Another strange or unusual aspect is the fact that it was a democracy before it ever really had an industrial sector or a modern economy, right from independence in 1947, which is again very unusual, if not unique in fact, in terms of the story of the developing world over the last two or three generations, particularly given that democracy has not only survived but has flourished and is really not at all in question. And the third and final sort of strangeness of its rise is it is now explicitly being promoted and desired by an outside power, that power namely being the United States. China is the US is really pushing India to develop more rapidly. It's provided this recent nuclear deal to help India become more of a mainstream nuclear power, and so that's the third strange aspect. The title, it was a sort of, the publishers wanted a slightly more populist title than The Strange Rise of Modern India. And this really denotes, In Spite of the Gods denotes, I think that this isn't a book about India's religious or spiritual traditions. There are many books that deal with that subject. But that it also isn't a book that necessarily pays the usual obeisance to India's religious traditions, which I have great respect, but which I don't think are to do with India's rise. I think India's rise is really about its secular democracy, which is what's made India India and kept India together as one nation. So In Spite of the Gods is really, it really connotes that. But the title I'd prefer to focus on is The Strange Rise of Modern India.
Yeah. You write about the legacies of three of India's 20th century leaders, and it is fascinating to see how these legacies are still at play in India today, although there have been some twists and turns along the way. Gandhi, Ambedkar, and Nehru. And the second name I mentioned, we're not really very familiar with him here, at least in the United States, with that name and his importance in India, modern India's history. Maybe here at the outset you'd give us a tiny tutorial on about these three men, their political views and strategies, and how they continue to affect India today.
Well, Gandhi, to start with, is of course well known to all Americans, he led the freedom struggle against the British. He made sure that it remained a peaceful struggle that was based on civil disobedience, on the political strategy, a non-violent political civil disobedience of embarrassing India's colonial rulers through public opinion, both in India and internationally, and shaming them into negotiating and making more and more concessions. And as such, I'm sure I don't need to tell most of your listeners, is one of the great figures of the 20th century, and deservedly so. His post-colonial legacy is perhaps slightly more mixed. Even though he died within a year of India gaining independence, he was assassinated in 1948. Even though he died then, his influence on India's economic strategy as a newly independent country was really very strong, and in some ways continues to be strong at the margins. And it was very much an anti-modern view of the economy, a belief that India should go back to really a semi-mythical age where everybody lived in the villages and was happy and all production was local and small is beautiful and so on and so forth, which I think has many modern Indian economists on the left and the right, such as Amartya Sen, who as you know is at Harvard, have pointed out was not particularly good for India's development. So I think in terms of Gandhi, wonderful figure, not remotely overshadowed by this post-colonial legacy, but nevertheless that's worth mentioning too. Nehru was India's first prime minister and by far its longest serving. He really gave India's political system the glue and the modern character that it has today and that strength that it has today. He was very different to Gandhi, but he was in many ways Gandhi's protege. Although Nehru didn't believe the small is beautiful thing to quite the same extent as Gandhi, Nehru was more of a sort of, he had a lot of sympathy with the Soviet economic model, no sympathy with the Soviet political model, but a lot of sympathy with a sort of this view that heavy industry is what defines a proud country. You know, the more steel you can produce, the more muscle you have as a nation. But he also, I think, most importantly, gave India two other things. One is its secular democracy, without which India wouldn't be India today, I don't think. And two, the Nehru-Gandhi dynasty. As you know, his daughter Indira Gandhi married somebody called Gandhi who had no relation to the Mahatma Gandhi. And that dynasty lives on today, and we're now really in its fourth generation with the young Rahul Gandhi, the son of Rajiv Gandhi, who was himself the son of Indira Gandhi. Rahul Gandhi is now in Parliament, and Rahul Gandhi's mother, Sonia Gandhi, the widow of Rajiv Gandhi, the Italian-born widow, is really the sort of de facto Prime Minister of India, even though she's not technically, not formally Prime Minister. So Nehru's legacy is everywhere. And finally, Ambedkar, you're absolutely right. Most people outside of India haven't heard of him. He was the first untouchable, that's a member of the lowest caste, or really outcast caste, the first ever Indian untouchable to be sent abroad to be educated. He actually went to Columbia Law School in New York, then went on to graduate as a barrister at Lincoln's Inn in London, and became very, very rapidly the leader of India's lowest caste, the untouchable caste. He renamed it the Dalit caste, which means broken or broken up or fragmented or smashed to pieces. And he really is deservedly, again, the icon, today in the early 21st century, even though he died, you know, in the mid-1950s, he remains the icon of India's lower castes, of the Dalits. Was a brilliant man. He was the chairman of the committee that drafted India's constitution. And help give India this document. It's a lot more wordy than the American constitution, it has to be said. But it fitted India. It fitted India's very diverse, heterogeneous social system, and gave it a democracy and a rule of law that it had never had. So he's a very great man, and he deserves to be as well known as Gandhi and Nehru.
Well, now let's talk about the economy, our first strange facet of modern India. Nehru, as you mentioned, he was interested in building an economy with heavy industry, but today the service sector accounts for more than half of India's economy. A couple of things here. Why did the vision for heavy industry fail, and what has allowed the service sector such prosperity?
I think the vision for heavy industry was really based not so much on economics as on politics. And the politics was really, India had been colonized. It had been a colony of Britain for 200 years or more, some parts for 300 years. And the way that it was colonized wasn't directly via the British Crown. It was via the East India Company. It was via a foreign investor that gradually sort of gained footholds in Indian markets and used that power to become a political player, and then gradually started playing off one prince against another and becoming India's de facto ruler. So if you like, the India's first foreign direct investor was also the company that colonized India on behalf of Britain. So there was a great deal of how should I put it? The freedom movement was inoculated strongly against the idea of India having an open economy. And if you remember, Gandhi, you know, based the whole symbol of the freedom movement on the spinning wheel, because the imperial system, economic system, was to take Indian cotton, raw cotton, send it over to Britain, turn it into clothes in the cotton mills of Lancashire, and then send it back to India, and as in the form of finished goods, and sell it to Indians, thereby capturing all the value added. So the idea was that India should be self-sufficient in everything. But you couldn't be self-sufficient in anything, according to the way Nehru thought, unless you produced, you know, the most complex industrial goods. And that meant you've got to produce steel so that you can build your own bridges, and you can build your own dams, and you can build your own railways, and so on and so forth. So the logic was impeccable. But of course, as a system of wealth creation and as a system of attracting investment, it really doesn't work. It didn't work in India, didn't work anywhere else in the world, doesn't work in North Korea either. This system of self-sufficiency quickly became a very contradictory one, where India was importing all these capital goods that would help them build their own heavy industry. But since exports weren't really encouraged, that wasn't the priority, they didn't have the money to pay for these imports. And so the system gradually went bankrupt. That's essentially, it took 4 decades to go bankrupt. But that's, in a nutshell, what happened.
What is the state of manufacturing today in India?
State of manufacturing today is really a sort of parallel story to the state of the service sector, which is that, again, counterintuitively, unlike what's happening in China, you're seeing complex manufacturing before you're seeing simple manufacturing. And one of the reasons that's happening, and one of the reasons why the service sector boomed so much, is because it's another legacy of Nehru, really, is that he poured money into higher education. And into universities, and he didn't put much into, or as much as he should have, into elementary education. So what India has is this slightly asymmetrical system where you've got a lot of, you know, very qualified English-speaking graduates around, but the labour force is semi-literate or illiterate. The shop floor sort of level isn't nearly as literate as their counterparts in China. Which means that India's competitive advantage is at the sort of complex end, where normally developed economies like the US or the UK are focused and concentrated. So manufacturing, you're getting complex sort of IT designed auto parts, customized supply to global supply chains, the kind of stuff that, or in the pharmaceutical sector, of course, lots of patents are being issued by Indian pharma companies. It's the kind of stuff that really draws on India's comparative advantage, not of cheap labor, but of cheap brains. Again, it's a sort of law of unintended consequences. All this you can really trace back to Nehru's vision of an economy, the socialist economy, that would be run by a technocratic elite.
But it's
turned out quite differently.
And speaking of the elite, English, the English language, has also been a part and parcel.
A very, very critical factor, one which China lacks. Nehru called English the glue of India. And it's interesting he should say that. What he meant by that was that every other language, including even Hindi, probably the most widespread Indian language, every other language was controversial to somewhere else in India. English, since the British departed, was really totally neutral. Everyone could speak it without causing suspicion to the people they were speaking to. So it became India's de facto official language of government, of the legal system in the courts, of the main newspapers and TV channels eventually. Of course, now Hindi is sort of really growing and becoming a national language. But English, was a political glue in his eyes. But of course, now it's a global competitiveness factor for India that no other developing country has on this scale.
Yeah. It seems to me that the 1990s were a watershed decade for India, and maybe you'll correct me if I'm mistaken here, but there were so many things happening. In 1991, more than self-sufficient in food production. The economy has expanded on average at 6% a year since 91. In the 1990s, India, you report, began to build roads that, in your words, could get you from A to B at something better than a canter. Were there other significant developments in the 90s, or maybe ahead of the 90s, that allowed India to accomplish so much so quickly?
Yes, I mean, I think, the funeral for the old economic system was in 1991, when India had this balance of payments crisis. But really, it had been dying for the previous 25 years. I think what had been creating new sense of opportunity in India, but it had been happening gradually, was something called the Green Revolution in the 60s and the 70s, which is whereby India started spreading more much higher yielding grains, wheat and rice grains, particularly wheat grains, that yielded two or three times as much per hectare as their previous varieties, some of which were developed by Rockefeller and Ford, some of which were developed by Indian scientists. The Green Revolution enabled Indian food production to overtake Indian population growth. So you went from a situation in the 60s, before the Green Revolution, in the 1960s, where India, in spite of being this self-sufficient, supposedly self-sufficient nation, was getting food aid, large-scale food aid, from the United States to really keep its people alive. The joke was that India was living ship to mouth. You've gone from that in the 1960s to, by the 1980s or even earlier, India being completely self-sufficient, as it remains, in food production, which, given the fact that its population had more than doubled since independence, was an extraordinary and remains an extraordinary accomplishment. And I think that built the sort of launching pad for the kind of surplus capital you get from a better agricultural growth to be invested in other parts of the economy. So you did have, higher growth rates in the 1980s before what I call the funeral for the old Nehruvian system was held in 1991. That I think is the most important thing that happened.
What was the license Raj?
License Raj is the system Nehru set up, whereby you needed the permission of the government to produce anything. You had quotas. If you were producing bicycles, you were given a quota of, say, 100 bicycles a month, and you couldn't exceed that. If you exceeded that quota, you would be fined, because the idea of the economy was it could all be rationally planned from the center, and bureaucrats would work out what demand was and then dictate supply to the producers, whether those producers were private companies or publicly owned companies. You needed a license to operate anything. You needed a license to hire somebody, to fire somebody, to expand production, to reduce production, to export, to import, to. And so, of course, what happened, this would work in practice if everybody, you know, working for the government was a genius, which, you know, is never the case. In practice, it's human beings who work for the government. So what happens is they have this thing that you want, which is a quota or a license, whatever, a piece of permission. That's rent they can charge you. So it really created a deeply corrupt system, as well as being economically inefficient, a deeply corrupt system where you had to pay a bribe as a company or a consumer for that matter. You had to pay a bribe to get anything done. By 1991, the queue to get a telephone, just a normal fixed line telephone, was 10 years long. They give you an indication of how much has changed since then. I can now walk into a shop in Delhi and get a telephone connected within 10 minutes. That's how bad it was.
That corrupt system, though, is there a hangover from it today?
Yes, but it's not so much focused on the sort of mainstream corporate world as it is on those in India who are outside of the market system, those in India who rely or should be relying on the state to give them a hand up, to give them some help in life, such as, you know, a decent primary education, such as literacy, or such as a road, an all-weather road to their village, or food rationing when there's food scarcity for their food supplies to get to them. It's at that level that it matters that corruption persists so much, and that's where corruption is the worst. About a quarter of India, that's sort of almost 300 million people, live below the poverty line of $1 a day. And it's simply not reasonable, no matter how fast growth continues to be in India, it's simply not reasonable based on past history or current sort of examples elsewhere in the world to expect the market to lift those people out of poverty. They don't read and write. Their children are chronically malnourished. They live in isolated rural pockets that aren't connected by infrastructure to the rest of the economy. They do need basic services. They do need basic skills that only the state can provide. And that's where corruption is most pernicious. That's where the state really, really most desperately needs to be reformed.
Yeah. How do the poor, people who are illiterate and cannot speak English, navigate this system?
You know, the average in North India, where most of the poverty is concentrated and where most of the population is concentrated, the average family, most families in the villages, will have one male working as a casualized laborer in the nearest town or big city. And so you have these sort of seasonal migration. They might work as construction workers, they might work as security guards or doormen or cooks or whatever. They will be outside the formal economy, but they will be remitting money. They'll be sending money back to the village in order to keep the village, their family in the village, going. The family itself is likely, because there are so many Indians, and it's not a huge country given how many people there are. I mean, it's smaller than the United States, but it has, 1.1 billion people. The average farmer's holding is only about 1 hectare, and that just isn't enough. It's not large enough to do anything more than sustain the family, to keep it alive. It's really not enough to be able to afford to, you know, an electricity connection or to send your children to a better school. The system is kept alive by the wealth to be found in the booming cities, and there's jobs to go for anybody. They might not be very grand jobs, but this is real money. And that's really why rural India isn't in bigger trouble than it would otherwise be, because it's sending its surplus men to urban India.
So there are opportunities for people in the cities, even as crowded and difficult as the situation is there for the poor.
Crowded and difficult by our standards visually, yes, but by the standards of the villages they're coming from, this is the streets are paved with gold. I mean that's slightly overstated, but there are economic opportunities, which is why they make that difficult and long and expensive journey. It is worth it. And I've seen many examples for myself of people who make that journey. They come, they're illiterate, they get a job, they save money, they put money away, and you'll find all of a sudden they've got children who are fully literate, out of the slums or back in the villages, who've been educated, who might even be English speaking, who will be going into real jobs. It's extraordinary, the sort of sense of energy and optimism and of opportunity that's around at the most desperately poor levels in India, and how many families, how many people are creating new opportunities for themselves because of the boom, the urban boom that's going on amongst the India's ever-growing middle classes.
Is this what we've also seen in China? Is it on that kind of scale?
It's beginning to get there. I mean, I've always said, and I think I say in the book, that if China didn't exist, we would be talking about the India miracle. In China, I think, though, the rate of urbanization is more rapid, and the number of formal jobs that are available to the poor are much greater. So I'd say it's not quite on the same scale, and it's not quite at the same speed, but it's still nonetheless at a phenomenally rapid speed what's happening in India.
Journalist Edward Luce is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of In Spite of the Gods, The Strange Rise of Modern India. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. Join the conversation with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Edward Luce is the Washington bureau chief for the Financial Times. He served as the paper's South Asia bureau chief and was based in New Delhi from 2001 to 2006. Let's go and talk out now about another one of the strange reasons for India's rise, modern India's rise, and that is its advantage of being a democracy. And this is something you say the country has achieved before having a sizable middle class or anything close to majority literacy among voters. How has India been able to accomplish this?
I think there are a number of reasons. You've really got to go initially to the character of the freedom movement and the influence that Gandhi and Nehru had on the freedom movement in order to have a broad-based freedom movement that included all of India's different communities. It's Hindus, it's Muslims, it's Christians, it's Sikhs, it's Jains, it's Parsis, and all of its castes from lower to upper, and all of its linguistic groups. India has 18 official languages, many of which have different scripts. These aren't dialects, these are really different languages. In order to have a national movement like that, for a nation that had never existed before as a nation, India might have always been there as a sort of civilizational block in the world, but it had never before it was colonized, been ruled from one place. In order to keep that kind of freedom movement together, you had to get into the habit of compromise. You had to get into the habit of democracy. This was not a guerrilla movement, with a Tito or a Mao leading it. This was a peaceful, non-violent political movement that relied upon the voluntary unity of its members in order to succeed, which it largely did. I say largely because, of course, Pakistan did happen. India was partitioned. So I think, first and foremost, the reason why India is a democracy is because of the freedom movement. To some extent, also, the method of shaming the British was to say, well, you give all these rights to your people. All we're asking is you treat us like, a little bit like George Washington used to say, you treat us like freeborn Englishmen. That's all we're asking. So in a sense, actually, the character of the colonizer, the character of the oppressor indirectly created the logic of having a democratic anti-colonial movement, because they were simply asking to be treated like British citizens were treated. But then, of course, there's the Indian tradition that goes back way further than colonialism, of diversity, of massive contradictory multiple social layers upon layers upon layers, which I think, you know, it sort of ingrains a habit in Indian culture of negotiation and compromise and peaceful dissent that, you know, predates all of this. So I think there are lots of reasons for it, and then there are one or two post-independence reasons that you could cite. The one I would pick on is the 19-month spell in the mid-1970s of autocracy, when Indira Gandhi suspended democracy for 19 months because she felt threatened for a number of reasons. Things went so wrong by the end of that I think it was a sort of object lesson to everybody. Contrary to some of the fashion at the time, actually democracy is good for development. It's good for India. It doesn't upset things. Autocracy created all sorts of, in that 19-month period, all sorts of separatist movements. You know, so India is only going to stay together as a nation by common consent. So I guess my conclusion is a long answer I've given you, but it is a very fascinating and complex question you asked. That in conclusion, what I would say is India is India because it is a democracy.
And how stable is this democracy?
Very stable, very stable. There are all sorts of pockets here and there of instability the whole time. I mean, I think I put this in the book as well. I mean, at any one moment, somewhere in India, there is a Tiananmen Square style protest, mass protest by somebody, farmers, students, whoever, workers. But they're never shot down, as the Chinese did in Tiananmen Square in 1989, as the communists did. They're never shot down. A few people might get beaten up, or they might be ignored, or they might win their demands. It's very common in India for protests to happen, but for them to be resolved undramatically. So it is a stable place. But even if parts of India are unstable at certain times, I mean, Kashmir is the obvious example. Punjab in the 1980s is another example, when there was a Sikh separatist movement. Because India is so diverse, that instability doesn't spread. Whereas again, if you look at China, if there's a student protest in one city, you can bet your bottom dollar there will be student rashes of protests breaking out all over the country the next day. It's a much more national culture in China. So India's diversity makes it stable.
So what's a national election like in India today?
Each national election in India is by definition the largest democratic exercise in human history, because India's population keeps growing and because it's by a factor of three the largest democracy in the world. It's an extraordinary event on many levels to watch. You know, I sort of reveled in covering Indian elections. You see so much colour, so much mass participation, so much enthusiasm, so much bewildering choice. You go into a polling booth, because a lot of the voters are illiterate, it's really the political sloganeering is all by symbol. So, you know, the Congress party has the hand, and the another party, the BJP, the Hindu Nationalist Party, has the lotus. Another party has an elephant. Another party has a bicycle. The voter needs to vote for a symbol, because they can't read some of them can't read the name of the party. So you've got this massive jumble of symbols everywhere, painted on the road, painted on the side of elephants, painted. It's really in many respects a very life affirming exercise in peaceful politics, and usually peaceful politics. I don't want to give an entirely rosy picture. People do die, there are riots, but generally speaking, it's a process that happens peacefully, in which the result is not disputed. People don't claim that cheating happened, scale to have changed the result. You get allegations here and there of ballot box stuffing, which does happen, but your opponent's doing it as well, and it generally balances out.
Yeah. In the 1950s, the illiteracy rate was above 80%. What is it like today?
Illiteracy would be about a third today by the same measure. Measure, can you sign your name? So it's not a very ambitious. It's not a very ambitious threshold to test whether you're literate or not. But but that is a fairly big difference between now and a generation or two generations ago. To go from, I think, 16% to 65%. The life expectancy in those days at independence was 32 years. Now it's about 65. It looks very good in relation to India's past. It doesn't look that good in comparison to what China's done. And it's a good comparison, not only because they're neighbors and they're both very large, but because you start the clock with each of them at about the same time. In India, you started in 1947. With independence, and with China, you started in 1949 with the Chinese Communist Revolution. And China does have much, much higher. I think China's literacy rate's approaching 90%. And its life expectancy is now, I think, about 70, 71. So, you know, in comparison to China, India has a lot of room for improvement. In comparison, though, to history, its own history or anyone else's, the speed of this change is fairly phenomenal.
Yeah. Also, again, here we have a situation where there can be vast regional differences within India. There is a state in India that has a literacy rate of over 90% and the longevity 74 years.
That's correct. Kerala in the south has and it's been rightly sort of picked out for. As a model other states in India should follow. Kerala, incidentally, for much of India's history, I mean post-independence history, has had a communist government. And the one thing that most people, anti-communist or otherwise, would agree about communist governments is that they are good at elementary education. They are good at getting, you know, Cuba had 100% literacy long before many parts of Latin America, or not 100%, but near universal literacy, as does Vietnam and China is approaching. So I think maybe there is something in the fact that Kerala had a communist government, albeit a democratically elected communist government. Go to Bihar in North India, which is one of India's poorest states. And it's home to 80 million people. And you'll get a literacy rate of more like 50%. And amongst women, it might be as low as about 35 to 40%. Bihar is one of the most caste-ridden states in the country, where caste conflict is perhaps, you know, at its most sort of feudal. And that's clearly held things back. So the variation, another cliche, but nevertheless accurate cliche that people sort of meet when they visit India, that I met every week, is what you feel when you move from an Indian city to the Indian countryside. It feels like you're moving from a sort of modernizing East Asian city, somewhere like Kuala Lumpur, say, straight into Chad, sort of the poorest sort of parts of sub-Saharan Africa. You know, that range is there. India is really more like a continent than a country in that respect.
Mm. How do Indians view that range, that gap?
Indians tend to think local. And by local, I don't mean, you know, tiny communities. I mean, if you're Bihari, you think local. You think about the state you're living in of 80 million people. And they tend to vote local. So it has state elections have higher voter participation than national elections because it's already on such a large scale in your state. If you measure federalism, the system is more federal. If a higher proportion of its public spending takes place at the state rather than at the federal level. So that makes it more federal in one way of looking at it. And India, by that definition, is the most federal country in the world, much more spending takes place in the state capitals than it does in New Delhi. And so more power, in other words, is devolved to the state units. So it's not entirely irrational that voters turn out in higher numbers for state elections.
Mm.
That's really where the action is. And that's why you get, to some extent, such divergence in how they're performing economically, with the South really, and parts of Western India, really beginning to take off.
And how do Indians view themselves as players on the world stage?
That is something that's changed quite profoundly in the last 10 to 15 years, and even in the last 3 to 4 years, particularly in the last 3 to 4 years. India, for the first time, sees itself, has a self-image of itself as a country that can compete globally. Where the rest of the world wants some of its products and expects it to be competitive, and that's quite new. I mean, the era of colonialism was very damaging to the self-esteem of people in India. It created a sense that the West is always superior. That, you know, India can never emulate the Western world. And I think that ghost has been exorcised. That damaged self-confidence has really been repaired mostly. And so Indians see themselves suddenly as advancing on the global stage, advancing peacefully, not as a nation that seeks other people's territories. In general, it's not an expansionist state, which will take its rightful place, you know, as one of the great powers of the world over the next few decades.
Yeah. India is a nuclear power. Its neighbor, Pakistan, also a nuclear power. What's the prospect for peace between the two?
I think it's better than it has been, but it can easily reverse. You've got a three-year-old peace process over Kashmir that's so far held steady. And both countries, of course, have many other preoccupations. I don't think Pakistan has enough problems on its border with Afghanistan to want to see a collapse in the peace process on its other border. Nevertheless, it's not been progressing very rapidly, and the two countries are no nearer seeing eye to eye over the disputed state of Kashmir than they were 3 years ago. So, although it's impressive, it's lasted this long, and it shows, you know, every sign of continuing, it is vulnerable to something like a big terrorist attack in India that could change public opinion very quickly. I wouldn't make the sort of complacent assumption that it's going to continue without some slightly more bold and imaginative statesmanship on the part of both India and Pakistan.
Yeah. Also, there is apparently a rise in the Hindu right wing. What's on the horizon there, do you think?
Hindu right wing, I'd say, is actually really on the retreat at the moment. I mean, it's rising. If you look at it, if you stand back and look at it over decades, I mean, it's in the 1980s it started rising, and it continued in the 1990s, got into government in 1998 and governed India for the first time. But it was thrown out of power in 2004, in the national election of 2004. So it's the opposition, the main opposition party now, but it doesn't seem to be handling opposition very well. India, you know, has continued to grow at a very rapid rate. The Congress Party, which is back in government under Manmohan Singh, is continuing the BJP's previous, BJP is the Hindu Nationalist Party, previous a realignment with America. And the nuclear deal is, of course, a deal Manmohan Singh signed. It's continuing the peace process with Pakistan. So I think Hindu nationalism is going through a slight crisis of identity at the moment. And given its record, given what happened to many of the Muslim communities, many of the Muslim minorities communities living in India under the BJP, their marginalization, some of the Hindu nationalist organized riots against them, I think this is no bad thing that it's on the retreat. I think it did pose a genuine threat to long-term Indian liberal democracy. if not to democracy itself, certainly to liberal democracy. And so its retreat, I believe, some people disagree with me, ought to be welcomed by all friends of India.
What kind of reception has your book seen in India?
I've been very fortunate. It's been sort of in the top two or three bestseller for non-fiction bestseller since I think I launched it last August. So it's been Indians are, you know, very interested in how the outside world perceives it, and it's not just written for foreigners. You know, I was based there 5 years, and my wife's Indian. You know, I feel a greater sort of affinity with India than anywhere else other than my home country. So I think, you know, that it was also written for an Indian, although principally for an international readership. It was also written so that Indians could get something out of it as well. So I think, you know, it's very nice to see that.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Edward Luce, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Edward Luce is Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He served as the paper's South Asia Bureau Chief and was based in New Delhi from 2001 to 2006. His book, In Spite of the Gods, The Strange Rise of Modern India, is published by Doubleday. And our thanks to Philip Derman at the Financial Times for his technical assistance there in our ISDN connection with Edward Luce this afternoon.